Blog Talk Radio.
Exposed radio show, part of the Freedomizer Radio Network. Yes, we trust science. It's just scientists we don't trust. Visit madscientists.exposed for many ways to listen or call in our live number at 319-527-6208. That's 319-527-6208. Press 1 to participate on the air. Again, that number is 319-527-6208. And now, here's our lead investigator, Suzanne.
Hi, and welcome to another exciting week with Mad Scientists Exposed. And we had a scheduled guest for today, but he's not feeling well and needs to reschedule. So I pulled up some articles that have been in the news lately. And my computer, I mute it so it's not competing with my phone, and it turns itself back on, and that really aggravates me. There's some websites that do that, and I'll find out which one it is and ban it from my list. Anyway, so I pulled up some articles that have been in the news lately. I know the front page of Drudge, he frequently has cutting-edge scientific articles, at least that give a gist of what's going on, and he's had quite a few the last couple of months. One today, and he just published this maybe within the last hour. Scientists make cells resistant to HIV. That's intriguing. And then there's a bunch of brain articles here from this past week and the weeks in the past. Scientists identify parts of the mind involved in dreaming. And I thought they knew that already. That's a surprise. Japanese scientists want to be the first to drill into the Earth's mantle. Yeah, how to pop a cork. I don't know if I'd want to do that. Scientists discover how memories are made. That's more brain research. Scientists detect atmosphere around Earth-like planet for the first time. Now, we learned from the NASA press conference a month or two ago that when they say Earth-like, they don't mean air and water and clouds and green grass and all that kind of stuff, or oceans and fish. They just mean it's in the same area of weight that the planet, or mass. The planet has a similar mass and maybe diameter to the Earth, and that's all they mean. The star that it's orbiting could be totally different. Its orbit could be totally different. And I read about this one yesterday. The one that they're talking about here is more Venus-like. Seems from the proximity to its own star. It's much closer to its own star. Its orbit is much shorter than our year, and it might be even so close as to be tidally locked so that it always has one face facing towards its star. And that seems to be the case with most of the seven TRAPPIST-1 planets they announced a month or two ago. So I don't have a whole lot of enthusiasm for this particular one. It looks more Venus-like to me. Here's one. Scientists enable paralyzed man to control his hands with his thoughts. And there's some very nice pictures in there. This is a man in a wheelchair. He's totally paralyzed, and he's able to feed himself from a bowl of mashed potatoes. But this, they've implanted in probes into his brain, and then they wire it to his arm, and that's how he's able to control the arm. And we did an episode on recovering from paralysis last summer sometime. I think maybe it was fall or summer, I'm not sure, but I can go back through the archives. But that was more people that are finding ways to heal spinal cord injuries. So I could read this, you know, we could go over this in a little bit and find out exactly why he's paralyzed. He could have a vaccine injury that is paralyzing people. There are people out there reading just today in, you know, one of the anti-vax groups on social media, this woman whose coworker was half his body was paralyzed recently from the flu shot that he didn't even want. So scientists turned spinach leaf into working heart tissue. Scientists puzzled by mercury's jump in Great Lakes fish. Now, they capitalized mercury there, so at first I thought they meant the planet. But they meant the element. But it's a title. That's why they capitalized it, I guess. Scientists that use graphene to power electronic skin that can feel. I wonder what that's about. I bet it's robotics. Scientists switch on artificial sun. I think that's the big spotlights they're putting up in Berlin. We should go into that one. Well, there's lots and lots of articles here. Artificial intelligence scientists gather to plot doomsday scenarios. Now, why would they plot doomsday scenarios? So if you have a preference as to what we'd like to talk about today, or if you'd like to talk about a little bit of everything, give us a call. The number is, 319-527-6208, 319-527-6208, and you can call it up and just listen like you're listening on a little transistor radio, or you can dial 1 and join the conversation, and I will give a check here, and somebody, you know, give us a call, or I'm going to just start reading and commenting on articles here, and I'll probably start with the scientists make cells resistant to HIV. That sounds intriguing. Boy, and all the best science articles are in the UK. But, you know, American science, I don't think, is really progressing all that. Or it's progressing, but they're not telling us. There's always a reason to keep something secret. Anyway, this is at thedailymail.co.uk. Scientists make cells resistant to HIV and major breakthrough against the disease. Scientists have discovered a way to make cells resistant to HIV. Antibodies that fight HIV are tethered to immune cell receptors. They block the virus from accessing the cell receptor and spreading infection. Cells without antibody protection die off, and protected cells pass on the protective gene to new cells. Researchers have found a way to make cells resistant to HIV. A new report reveals. They're not linking to it, huh? In a major breakthrough, scientists have tethered HIV-fighting antibodies to immune cells, creating a cell population resistant to the virus. These resistant cells can quickly replace diseased cells, making it more effective than other therapies and potentially curing the deadly disease. That's why it's not in the American press. It's actually illegal to cure anything here. You can't say the word cure or the FDA comes after you. Anyway, the researchers plan to collaborate with investigators at City of Hope's Center for Gene Therapy in California to evaluate this new therapy in efficacy and safety tests as required by federal regulations prior to testing in patients. In California, huh? Gene therapy, huh? The research conducted at the Scripps Research Institute, and I have a story about them, boy, in San Diego, California, first tested their system against rhinovirus, which is responsible for many cases of the common cold. So would any of you want to undergo gene therapy to avoid getting the common cold? Just change your identity? Just rewrite your DNA? I don't know. Anyway, they used a vector called lentivirus to deliver a new gene to cultured human cells. The team then had cells synthesize antibodies that bind with human cells, with human cell receptors that rhinovirus needs to gain access. With the antibodies monopolizing that site, the virus cannot enter the cell to spread infection. It'll just move along in your bloodstream. Cells without antibody protection died off, leaving protected cells to survive and multiply, passing on the protective gene to new cells. And presume to any children you might have after that point. In the technique tested against HIV, all strains of the virus need to bind with a cell surface receptor called CD4. C as in Charlie, D as in David, 4. After introducing cells to the virus, the researchers ended up with an HIV-resistant population. The antibodies recognized the CD4 binding site, blocking HIV from getting to the receptor. This is really a form of cellular vaccination, said senior author Dr. Richard Lerner, professor of immunochemistry at TSRI. That's the Scripps Institute. I believe that's the Scripps Institute. Well, I lost it on the page. Researchers say the new technique offers a significant advantage over therapies where antibodies float freely in the bloodstream at a relatively low concentration. Dr. Jia Xie, a senior staff scientist at TSRI and first author of the study, called it the neighbor effect. An antibody stuck nearby is more effective than having many antibodies floating through the bloodstream. They think so, huh? The scientists further confirmed that these tethered antibodies block the HIV more effectively than free-floating, soluble antibodies in experiments led by the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative. So this is a vaccine. The ultimate goal will be to control HIV in patients with AIDS without the need for other medications. Well, that would be wonderful. If you've already got AIDS, then I suppose this would prolong your life, although if you intend to have children, that you're manipulating the genes you're going to be passing on to your children, so I hesitate to recommend that. Although the annual number of new HIV diagnoses declined by 19% from 2005 to 2014, the disease is still prevalent. More than 1.2 million people in the U.S. are living with the virus, and 1 in 8 of them don't know it. If they don't know it, then they're asymptomatic. And we covered that a couple weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago. We talked about a documentary that had gotten banned out of a lot of European film festivals. But it did play in Brooklyn or Queens, and that's when we covered it, of people who were HIV positive in a small town in Spain, and for their own reasons, they rejected the chemical cocktails, the pharmaceutical cocktails they were prescribed, and just went on with their lives, and they never developed symptoms. They just tested positive, but the positive was just an antibody count. So there's a lot of confusion out there, I guess I could say, in the HIV industry. Anyway, HIV is treatable but not curable. This remains a disease that causes a lot of suffering, and I'm quoting here. That makes the case for why these technologies are so important, said Dr. Joseph Alvarez from City of Hope. In addition to the collaboration, Dr. Xie said the next step in this research will be to try engineering antibodies to protect a different receptor on the cell surface. Why? Dr. Carl Diefenbach of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease told Daily Mail Online that while the design of the idea is interesting, there is a fundamental problem when it comes to gene therapy. How do you know how to put antibodies into the right cells, he explained. HIV is notorious for generating large variations, and what will happen is that some population of the virus will not bind to the antibody, so you'll kill off sensitive cells, but the virus will continue to grow. With antiretroviral drugs, we have to use a 3-drug cocktail because of the virus's many variations, so you would have to use a similar cocktail of antibodies. So they would have to manipulate, I guess, 3 genes. Dr. Diefenbach added that while there have been several tantalizing research breakthroughs in the last 5 years, the new findings have yet to be proven in clinical trials. We have amazing therapy and really effective therapies, very good tools, but we're not at the point yet where we can make better tools like a cure or a vaccine, he said. I wish people wouldn't conflate cures and vaccines. A vaccine leaves people that are already sick behind. A cure helps people that are already sick. Now, what either of those do to people that aren't sick, that are asymptomatic, I don't know, when these people start meddling in your DNA, I always feel a little kinky about that. And then there's a whole bunch of comments on here. So, a subject we covered a few weeks ago. Oh, next year, scientists identify parts of the mind involved in dreaming. And let me check the phone bank here. We do have a question, a flag here for somebody to join our conversation. and it looks like it's our friend Ed. Hi, Ed.
Hello.
Is that you? Hi. You
yes,
have thoughts already.
Yeah. Huh? I'm trying to tune in to your subjects today, but I can't find the focus. I can't really find the focal point of.
I'm not focused yet. I was waiting for input from our guests, from our callers.
You're going in that direction,
you know.
Huh? Yeah, that's good.
Well, I have a lot. There's a lot of science that's going on out there, so I'm just going down the headlines.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. Don't let me stop
and
you.
It's always me stop you.
But you know,
right.
You know, when
it's
you say science,
have...
science is such
sorry?
A broad term. I was thinking.
Yeah.
You know, at one time I was very interested in earthquakes, and of course that would be seismology, right? So,
yep.
You know, a person could look up advances or research papers or theories in seismology and seismic
Well, there's
you know,
some, there's
like
some earthquake headlines here from just March 9th,
oh,
so
really?
That's barely a month ago.
Oh, okay.
Yep, scientists say...
No, I saw some too. I didn't see anything really big.
Well,
I haven't seen really big earthquakes or anything like that, but I did find it.
Well,
find
I posted him on Mad Scientist that exposed that the whole possible topics.
Okay.
And so, and oh, you know,
you mean you're drawing from your own database there? Oh.
Well, what I did is I went to Drudge and I searched the archives, and then I pasted like the first 100, which is about 3 months worth, in.
Yeah, cool.
So I have a a non-changing page. It frustrates me,
wow.
You know, you know, you click to another page and you come back and it goes from 100 search items to 12 and you have to re-expand it and just...
Mm-hmm.
So I tricked it. So anyway, I just copied and pasted it.
Oh, okay. So you're basically on a roll right now. Maybe I should yeah. just sit back and listen. Or something as you go through your list.
Yeah, but I'm always on the lookout because I've seen what happened with you know people with serious medical conditions in my own family, and what I've seen with people on social media with the vaccine industry and how I'm convinced now that it's weaponized and that every science out there there's a weaponized every science, and so mm-hmm. and if there's a possibility, you know, for every, I would say, you know, for every, you know, 100 or 1,000 well-meaning scientists, there's a few that are actually malevolent, you know, just, you know,
wow.
a handful or two or three or whatever. And so we end up with, you know, Dr. Mengele types and Dr. Pan in California. And I think there's another one. And we, you know, we end up with people like Bill Gates who have their fingers meddling in the vaccine industry because they actually have a depopulation agenda and they're actually,
wow.
you know, intentionally weaponizing vaccines. And so I've been seeing, you know, every science has a way to weaponize it. And so you got to be on guard against it. But, you know, some of these
yeah.
methods of, you know, these people are, you know, creatively evil and you have this, it's almost impossible to stay a step ahead of them. So,
well,
you know,
all,
as long as we
recognize
that there is this...
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
I was going to say, after all, your group is madscientists.exposed, so...
Yes, and that was my story about
exposed.
The scripts. So I just went over this article about the research on HIV, and it requires manipulating your DNA and changing your genes and injecting these genes into you, which... presumably get passed on to your children then, because that's a permanent identity change to you. But, yeah, the Scripps Institute, I saw one of their scientists, Dr. I want to say Silver or something like that. It's way back when I first started the Mad Scientist Exposed website. I saw her interviewed on mm-hmm. Greta Van Susteren, and she's a researcher for, it's Sapphire. Her name is Sapphire.
Oh, yeah.
With two P's. But she was being
interviewed
on Greta Van Susteren, and she was researching Ebola, or a vaccine for Ebola, not a cure. She was researching a vaccine for Ebola. And my guess is they're going to apply this HIV stuff to everything else. Ebola went away on them. And there were actually articles out, scientists bemoaning that Ebola burned itself out before they could start manipulating and getting a vaccine.
Yeah.
But this woman... she started out okay, and then she started drifting into this glee, about all the research she was doing and how fascinated she was with the Ebola virus and how she could make it take this form and that form and do this and do that. And she was, I mean, Greta could barely get a word in edgewise. This woman was so in love with her work, which is fine, you know, if you're, you know, eliminating human suffering. Excuse me. But then she turned into actual expressing happiness over human suffering, because that would mean that she would continue to get funding. She said this, that it would help the economy because they would have to keep funding her research on Ebola. And and I'm like, oh, my God. She thinks that people suffering helps the economy when it's actually, if nobody's suffering, the economy is even better because people aren't missing work. People aren't dying young and leaving dependents on the state behind, you know, being a drag on the economy. Yeah. And, you know, it was really, really sick. And Greta was just stunned. Their mouth was like, you know, and I was so upset that I actually saw a mad scientist with my own eyes that I blogged and blogged and blogged. And I've got a separate political blog where I was blogging. And I'm like, this isn't enough. I have to get on this and get after these scientists. So that's when I started the Mad Scientist Exposed website. And but the bottom line of the story is it's kind of funny. You know, I have tracking in my websites, and you know, I see some interesting IP addresses come through, people visiting and stuff. And folks, you need to use something different besides Google Analytics. I'm not saying don't use Google Analytics. They have a lot of good, you know, if you're using Google Analytics, then you can do the AdSense and all that kind of stuff. But they don't give you the IP address of your visitors. They retain that for their own purposes. And these are people that are visiting your website that you're paying hosting for. You have a right to know at least where they're coming from, what their ISP is. And so after I've started blogging about this Ebola woman, I looked at my tracking, and there was the Rockefeller Institute, you know, the drug institute.
Oh, wow.
And like, what? Yeah, they're the ones that do all the mad scientist stuff on the East Coast. And then, you know, like half a day later, the Scripps Institute starts coming through. Several different IP addresses from the Scripps Institute. And I'm like, whoa, somebody at the Rockefeller Institute must have emailed that woman. She came in. So I had to say about her, I've never seen her on TV again. Because I don't know if she was angry or not. I don't care. But it exposed, I mean, for all the world on national television, how really, really unconcerned about human suffering some of these scientists are. She was absolutely happy that it was going to boost her paycheck, you know, this Ebola
research.
If
people weren't suffering, she wouldn't have much to do, you know.
She didn't have any class. You know, I don't know how else to say it. She wasn't happy to be solving human suffering because she wasn't actually. Her goal with the vaccine is to prevent human suffering, but the people that are already suffering, they just get it. Oh, well, just die and be over it. That's the easiest thing for us to do, and we'll sell vaccine to the rest of the population. And there is no way in heck they were ever going to inject any form of Ebola into me. You know, if a vaccine came out, I mean, there were movements on Facebook banning the Ebola vaccine and all this kind of stuff because, you know, alive or dead or attenuated or whatever they want to do to it, there is no form of that virus that they're going to inject into me. And no way, no how. And I made my adult kids promise never to allow them to vaccinate them with an Ebola vaccine. You know, they should have been focusing on curing the people in Africa that were being hit with it. That's what they needed to focus on, and they didn't. They wanted to terrorize us. They saw this large American market and the whole market, the rest of the world besides Africa. They wanted to terrorize us into getting this Ebola vaccine, and we weren't going for it. And I was angry that that was her attitude. And I was so angry that I've gotten into this for years now, you know. But I just love having those IP trackers in my websites because I can see people tippy-toeing through. And I know she knows what I said about her, you know.
Power, having those IP trackers. That's great.
Yeah, I've caught trolls.
It seems to me that's not the only example of a mad scientist that's bragging getting all excited about people possibly suffering and dying. Didn't even Bill Gates let something out about the fact that he was looking for depopulation or something, like he had an agenda for depopulation. Did he actually
implement,
say it, or did people just imply it or infer it?
No.
Yeah.
There's videos on YouTube. He said it more than once. And they come they go by so fast, it's almost like a little Freudian slip, like Sean Spicer's mistake today. But that was a bad one. But in fact, General Mattis said the same thing in different words, but he said the exact same thing in his press conference today, and you know, about no chemical weapons have been used since World War One, and that was not true in Hitler's case. And that wasn't true in it wasn't true in Hitler's case, and so they both misstated what they were saying. You know,
Spicer actually said for a degenerate or whatever he said, like Hitler, he never used chemical weapons. And immediately it popped in my mind. Well, what about the gas they used on the in the concentration camps?
That earned him a front page on Drudge today. That's really bad. That is really, really bad, and I don't know if it's career-ender or not. But, you know, I kind of like him, but now this is a bad one. I don't know.
Slip of the lip.
Oh, man.
In World War II, they said the slip of the lip sinks ships, you know. So.
Yeah, that was more about secrecy.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's my take on the vaccine industry, and I've since seen some other sciences that there's secretive weapons and stuff, and we've talked about some of those too in past episodes. But how about the one with the guy with the paralyzed? He can feed himself now.
He can see himself?
Feed himself, quadriplegic man. Man's arm and hand brought back to life through thought control tech. That's kind of scary, the idea of thought control tech. During trials, Bill Kokovar grasped and lifted objects after having dozens of electrodes implanted in his brain and right arm. So they made a cyborg out of him. They didn't heal the neurological damage that he's got. A quadriplegic man has had his right arm and hand brought back to life with the help of technology, and that's the wonderful thing for him. His life is drastically improved now, but I'm always thinking it could be better. So Bill Kokovar, 56, was paralyzed below his shoulders in a cycling accident 8 years ago, but can now grasp and lift objects after having two pill-sized electrodes implanted in his brain. The electrodes record the activity of brain neurons to generate the signals that tell another device to stimulate muscles in the paralyzed limb. So they're replacing his own neurologic system with robotic stuff. During trials held at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, Mr. Kokovar raised a mug of water to his lips and drank from a straw. He also scooped forkfuls of mashed potatoes from a bowl. Mr. Kokovar from Cleveland said the technology was better than I thought it would be. He said, for somebody who's been injured 8 years and couldn't move, being able to move just that little bit is awesome to me. The trials were part of the BrainGate 2 study, which is exploring the safety and feasibility of using brain-computer interface system to help people paralyzed by spinal injuries. In preparation, Mr. Kokovar learned how to use his brain signals to move a virtual reality arm on a computer screen. After 4 months of practice, another 36 electrodes were implanted into his upper arm and lower right arm. His upper and lower right arm. Pulses sent through the electrodes trigger muscles and regulate movements of hand, wrist, arm, elbow, and shoulder. Mr. Kokovar was fitted with some mobile support, which he also controls with his brain to counterbalance the force of gravity. His 56-year-old told researchers he was able to control the muscle activation system without having to really concentrate hard on it. He's been learning the biofeedback techniques. He is believed to be the first person in the world with quadriplegia to have arm and hand movement restored by two kinds of implant. Research lead Dr. Bob Kirsch said the study was really breaking ground for the spinal cord injury community. He said this is a major step forward, restoring some independence. Well, yeah, that could be wonderful for him. he's always dependent now on having people maintain his robotic parts. We did do an episode a few months ago on a quadriplegic, I believe, and a paraplegic that both had spinal cord injuries that covered in different ways. The one used some kind of Chinese meditation, and he basically meditated himself back. I don't know how, he was soaking in a tub, concentrating like this guy concentrated in practice. And this guy was in, I think it was Oro Valley, Arizona, and the other guy was in Tucson, about 30 miles away. The guy in Tucson is a young guy in his 20s, recently married, and he had heard about some stem cell research in India. And he went there, and they had his leg moving within a day of his surgery.
Wow.
And I don't know how far he's progressed since then. I wonder if I could find him and interview him. I don't know. I don't know if I could find him. You hate to intrude on somebody's life, but he was in the paper. He traveled the world.
Makes him a public figure.
Anyway, there are things, and he's healed, and he's not dependent on robotics, either of them, supposedly.
Hmm.
Why aren't they like talking to their Indian counterparts? How are you doing this? Because
language barrier.
Well, come on, they speak English in India, especially in medical school.
I don't know.
Anyway, so that's just my thoughts.
I was just going to say, if the American had gone to Harvard University, he certainly couldn't be expected to have much of a conversation with a Indian who had graduated from Pune University in central India.
They're doing work in India that it doesn't appear that we're doing here in the U.S. And why is that? If you heal somebody, he can then walk away from his doctors. If you implant probes into somebody's brain and arm, he's dependent on his doctors the rest of his life. That's whereby I'm a little bit jaded about that stuff. And so this isn't weaponized, but this is not healing people. This guy's life is now improved, and God bless him. But I want better for everybody. I want better. My only question with the Indian therapy was, is it embryonic stem cells, or are they taking stem cells out of your own body, out of your own bone marrow, or whatever? I know they can now revert adult cells from non-marrow parts of your body back to, embryonic state or stem cell state.
Oh.
And then they can cause it to differentiate the way they prefer, and if they're patching up your spinal cord, they need the spinal cord cells to do that. So standing still and moving ahead, who knows?
Well, get them off the doctors for sure. Make it possible for the people to be able to not have to connect with the MDs, every week or every month. That reminds me of, who was it in New Jersey? A guy whose doctor said, you're going to be on this med for the rest of your life. It was something about diabetes or something. I think you had something like that in your family too.
Was it somebody that you knew? They told her, you're going to die of cancer within six weeks or 6 months or something. And she said, God and I will decide. and she lived like another 9 years. Another 9 years, It finally caught up with her, but, you can't have scientists instruct you that you're going to die and that you should give up all hope. And the fact that I remember that one guy who meditated himself completely, he had been, the Oro Valley guy, he'd been in, I think it was a skiing accident up near Flagstaff. And he went through therapy, and they were teaching him how to do his little puffer blower to control his wheelchair and his computer or whatever. And he's like, okay, when do I start the therapy to learn how to walk again? And they argued with him. No, you have to just accept your fate. Accept your fate. Accept your fate. Sit down in that wheelchair. Don't you dare try to do anything else. And it was really, really obnoxious. And he had to fire them all. Get away from them. They were just too negative.
Yeah.
So I remember that story. It sticks out in my mind. And that's way back, like last, I don't know, June or July or something. I don't know. So here's scientists identified parts of the mind involved in dreaming. I wonder if they'll put implants in your brain to your dreams. I know they're trying to read your dreams. They're trying to read your thoughts, and they're reading enough of this man's thoughts that he can move an arm. So I don't know. Experts say findings are astounding and could help understand the purpose of dreams and predict whether people are dreaming. Well, you know, if they can do all this, they can also read the brainwaves of people in comas. And we have a lot of people that are being starved to death right now. Yeah, I mean, they'll declare you brain dead. They'll declare you brain dead and either, withdraw your life support, or they'll take your organs or whatever. There was that Jahi McMath case years ago in California. Yeah. But I don't remember anything in those articles about them ever trying to read her brainwaves to find out if she was awake or asleep. And she does respond to commands. Her mother managed to get her out of California, and if you tell her to move her toes, she moves her toes. There's somebody's in there, and even if their lives are not the lives we would want for ourselves, why take away what little they've got left? That's kind of my way of looking at it. I don't know.
Yeah, they make it tough for sick people and for older people. So nowadays, they're even making it tough for babies and toddlers, with the
horrible story out of the UK today. A baby with some kind of mitochondrial disease, and he needs a ventilator to live. And he's in an NHS hospital, of course, and the doctors decided they're done taking care of him. The ventilator is just prolonging his death. It's just prolonging his death. And so we want to take him off the respirator. So the parents went to GoFundMe, and they accumulated like over $1 million to get him to the U.S., to get the baby to the U.S., to get an experimental treatment here. And the doctors went to court to stop him. Why?
Why would they do that?
Yeah, so what happened was, the judge ruled for the doctors and announced this in court, and, the parents are weeping, and, the father's crying out. It was just a horrible thing to read. And I figured it out. Suppose they took that baby to the U.S. and got him a treatment that gave him a good life. It would have exposed the incompetence of the doctors at the NHS. So they would rather put that baby 6 feet under than allow him to leave the country where they weren't willing to help him anyway. That's where I see mad scientists.
Could the parents not have simply taken the baby, put him on the jet, and gone to the United States? Could they have not,
Then you're stealing a ventilator. They wanted to take that ventilator off that baby. So I don't know if they can force a purchase of the ventilator and just wheel them out. I don't know. And there are lots of people living years and years on ventilators. I mean, Christopher Reeves, who was another quadriplegic patient, he lived on a ventilator for years. There's, Stephen Hawking. He's been on a ventilator for years and years. That's why his talking is just a computer-generated voice, But
Do you remember what happened to Christopher Reeve? Did he have an accident? Was he in, like, a car crash or something? Because I don't remember what happened.
It was a horse accident. He was riding his horse and taking a jump, and he got the horse stopped short, and that was for him. And he lingered for years. So
terrible
he lingered
thing.
For years, and then he just died one day. And kind of like, that friend of ours, the musician in Tucson.
The motorcycle accident.
There was a motorcycle accident. Yeah, he lingered for about 7 months, and he was only in his 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And, and he just suddenly died one night. And, he'd been through a lot. His family had been through a lot. And I don't really know what he died of. But I guess people that are immobile are prone to various pneumonias.
Yeah, and also totally depression. I imagine he must have been very depressed, knowing that he was not going to move anymore.
Maybe.
And, really
maybe.
Have a life
anymore. He was well-loved in the community. They had had a big, huge celebration for him. It was a money-raising celebration for retrofitting his house for all his equipment. And, it was a big outpouring of love in the community for him. And he died within a week of that. I think it was a week. It was very short after that big celebration. Because he had been a musician, so there were concerts and dancers and stuff like that. And, Anyway,
oh, yeah, that
that's why this issue bothers me so much. It was the same thing. They sent him out of state to therapy, and it was mainly to learn how to drive his wheelchair, and you know, and talk through his ventilator between breaths. You know.
Now what about Stephen Hawking? Has Stephen Hawking been like this all his life, or was it a degenerative condition that came on over the last 20 or 30
condition.
Years?
It's a degenerative condition that he got. He's got ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease.
It started in the 20s.
Yeah, I forget what the ALS stands for. That's, you know, the medical term for it. And he got it in his 20s. And when people get ALS, sometimes they're only a few months to live. But he's managed to live many, many years since then. It was in the 60s that he came down with it. And here it is, 2017.
Yeah.
So,
he must have the
very best of care. Aggressive care, and people, you know, feeding him right and whatever. And and it's just kind of sad. And I can't prove anything about where he got the Lou Gehrig's disease, but I sure have my suspicions because as soon as I started getting the thought that every weird neurological disease is caused by vaccines, I went searching to find out what his family history was. And his father was a researcher of exotic African parasites. And he would go to Africa around that time, late 50s or so, he would go to Africa to study these weird parasites.
Oh,
and
lovely.
A parasitologist. Yeah. So I'm kind of thinking, well, when you're doing something weird like that, you're either carrying it home or something got out or you've been vaccinating the heck out of your family. I don't know.
Either the vaccine got him or the parasites. If the parasites weren't going to get him, then the vaccine did, it sounds like. And if he went with them repeatedly, I guess they gave him repeated injections, you know, to keep
Well,
it going.
I can only guess. You know, I'm not privy to his private medical, papers or records.
Different parts of Africa would have different needs. There'd be malaria here and dengue fever there and yellow fever here and anthrax there. You know, every part of Africa would have a different disease.
But
they might have to...
And some vaccines shed. Some vaccines shed. So maybe the father was only vaccinating himself, but he came home and shed on them. I can't prove any of it. I just have my suspicions.
But there's been several cases. Hasn't there been several cases where it's been very suspicious that a child, for example, that was doing just fine and didn't have any health problems, gets kind of sneezy and pale and has all kinds of, you know,
hives and rashes
problems.
And eczema and
asthma. Shortly
after
getting vaccines, shortly after vaccinations.
Yep.
The mothers
Trump
sometimes
said,
don't even
know.
I said, oh yeah. Well, he went to the pediatrist. No.
Pediatrician.
I guess they gave him a shot. I guess they had to give him a
shot.
And
now they're like triple loading these shots.
There
they're triple loading these shots, and you know some kids will come out of there with five and six different. Then they wonder why they have a neurological and immunological breakdown, why they're sick for the rest of their childhood. Not everybody puts it together, you know, or they'll have doctors lie right to their faces, even if the stuff is listed in the package insert.
Well, I knew there was something wrong even when I was 8 years old or 9 years old, you know, and they gave us, what was it, measles, mumps, diphtheria, I don't know.
Polio. Polio and smallpox.
Well, I don't think that this was polio. I'm not sure. But, you know, everybody's waiting in line. As I recall, everybody had their shirt off, you know. I guess the boys anyway, had, you know, their shirts off and stuff, and then they got the shot. And, you know, what kind of crap is it that will form a crater on your arm like that in a couple of days?
I think that's smallpox.
It's like crazy. Well, this is what you must have gotten in because it. That's
one. Yeah, that's the one that makes the scar on your arm, and I think I still have the scar. I don't remember
it
itching
like
or anything.
It looks like a lunar crater. It looks like a lunar crater from one of these Secure 10 videos. You know? But I mean, for it to do that, that's got to be a partial encounter with the actual smallpox, virus.
Yeah.
And that's scary.
Well, they're
that's
saying,
scary.
They used to say that they would vaccinate you with the cowpox, which is related to smallpox, but they were noticing the milkmaids. That was the story about it. you know, the buffets and if they had cowpox, then they wouldn't get the smallpox. Okay, I'm pulling up search engine image of smallpox scars. I have to look in the mirror to find out. I can't see my arms very well. I'm at the wrong angle. I need a mirror. So, but yeah, you're right. They look like moon craters.
That's
kind of sad,
My shirt won't grow up high enough to see it. But I think I can actually feel it with my fingers. It's slightly sensitive.
Wow.
After 40 or 50 years, I can find it.
The skin is thinner there, huh?
Well, and in the very center, it rises up a little bit. There's a little bulge in the very center, and then around it is a like a caldera, you know, like a little crater and then a rim around it. But, I mean, you got to be very sensitive to this kind of thing. But, yeah, I definitely was aware of that. And it seems like a hell of a thing. But then I guess a smallpox epidemic would have been pretty bad, too. But how much risk was there of a smallpox epidemic in Northern California in the mid-1950s? I mean,
I'm not really sure if that makes sense. Yeah. I need to take a commercial break. I'm behind on commercial break, so I think I better do this. Okay, we'll be back.
Sure.
Are you looking for a new place to shop, eat, and save? Are you sick of paying full price? Would you like to save money at the places you enjoy most? Well, here's a popular savings book that is full of coupons catered to your local area. It's called Save Around. This book is full of exclusive discounts to help you save money around your town. Yes, that's Save Around. You will save money at restaurants, department stores, cars, even flowers. When I take my family out, there are seven of us. The average meal was about $110 to $140. Last time I took them out, and I'm holding a copy of the receipt right here, the check originally was $120. With the Save Around book, our meal cost $82 at a place we go to quite often. Who knew? And there are a few places we found that we are going to check out. View the books in your area before you buy. Go to freedomizerradio.com or barefootislegal.org. Just click on your city, and within a few days, you will be saving money around town with your new Save Around book.
There are reports that say sitting all day at work is just as unhealthy as smoking. There is a hot new health trend called earthing, where you leave your shoes at home and you go out for a walk in the park. However, most of us work all day. This is where Serenity Rug comes in. Serenity Rug is meant to let you feel the grass beneath your feet while you have to stay inside and get your work done. This revolutionary footrest encourages movement and blood flow so you can feel better while working. Relieves muscle tension, improves circulation at your own desk while you're working. Anyway, please check out SerenityRug.com. That's SerenityRug.com.
You know the Constitution like the back of your hand. You've read books, listened to podcasts, attended lectures, surfed websites, and watched videos. You've made liberty your life's goal. But something seems to be missing. Stickers from LibertyStickers.com. Exercise your freedom of speech with the world's most dangerous bumper stickers. That's LibertyStickers.com. But wait, there's more. You can buy Liberty stickers wholesale. Get them for 99 cents each when you put 100 or more in your shopping cart in any combination. Sell them or give them away. They're great for gun shows, flea markets, fairs, outreach, and more. Earn extra money, promote freedom, and spread the word. Need custom stickers, labels, or decals for your organization or business? Liberty Stickers makes them. Go to LibertyStickers.com to order or call 877-873-9626. LibertyStickers.com, the world's most dangerous stickers.
Call in our live number at 319-527-6208. That's 319-527-6208. Press 1 to participate on the air.
Vaccines are required for students, employees, immigrants, military members, and international travel. Do you know how to legally avoid them? This is vaccine rights attorney and Freedomizer radio host Alan Phillips. My vaccine exemption ebook can help you avoid the mistakes that have cost others their exemption rights. Get the authoritative guide to vaccine legal exemptions, an ebook available at freedomizerradio.com and vaccinerights.com.
Let freedom ring throughout the land.
Do you want to live a happy and healthy barefoot lifestyle? Join Barefoot is Legal Saturdays, 1:30 p.m. Eastern, 10:30 a.m. Pacific Time to learn your rights to live a barefoot lifestyle. There are no laws against bare feet in public, and we are here to dispel the myths and empower you to stand up for your rights. Join full-time barefooter and victims legal advocate Nick Pierce on Freedomizer Radio or the Barefoot is Legal radio show Saturdays, 1:30 p.m. Eastern, 10:30 a.m. Pacific. And check out barefootislegal.org.
Yeah, it's kind of strange. I was reading the Barefoot is Legal Facebook page today, and somebody started sending private messages to that page just harassing people for wanting to walk around barefoot. And it's like, what do you care what I do? It was very strange. And he got quite abusive, and we had to send him packing, just ban him from the page.
Wow.
It's kind of strange. Yeah, like, why do they care? You know, well, go get a life, mister. But that's the reason for that group, that Barefoot is Legal, because barefooters do get a lot of harassment, and they get lied to quite often. I mean, they've done their research as to going barefoot is legal in all 50 states, and driving while barefoot is legal in all 50 states, and, you know, but they get people walk up to them and just get in their faces, and like, why? Leave me the heck alone, you know. Anyway.
Well, it seems to me that people that are barefoot may be healthier and have less germs than some people that have been walking around in shoes all day. But let's say they've been wearing those shoes for a few days. Let's say that they stepped someplace that a barefoot person wouldn't step. You know, maybe there was some nasty stuff, or some bird stuff, or whatever, something on the sidewalk. You know, and you don't think about it, you just step in it. And so they're walking around now forever with these dirty shoes that have bugs on them, or that have germs on them, or whatever, you know.
Yeah,
toxic
or just
well, you know,
where your feet can't breathe.
You wouldn't walk around with bare feet that have stepped on toxic stuff, because you'd wash them every so often. I'm sure those people
wash exactly,
their feet
the argument.
Every day.
Yeah.
And they're cleaner than.
You know, people with sunshine between their toes don't get the funguses in an athlete's foot and stuff that people in shoes, that's, you know, I pretty much stay pretty close to home if I'm barefoot, but I am barefoot a lot around the home.
So people wearing shoes and socks all the time, they're suffocating their feet. They're just suffocating their feet.
Yeah.
And that makes them subject to getting what?
Some people prefer wearing shoes, particularly if they live in super hot or super cold. There's some people that will tough out the super hot or the super cold, but some people prefer their shoes. And, you know, everybody has a right to their style. And so I was just shocked that people get in these people's faces. So just one of those things.
Well, you must admit that if you're living in a place like Phoenix, Arizona in the summer, you probably need to wear shoes if you're walking around, because that sidewalk can get very hot. Parking lots can get very hot. You know?
I don't know how they tough it out. Some people. When it's super hot like that.
What if they're wearing just flip flops? In other words, you know, you just have
that
a strap.
That puts a little buffer between you and the sidewalk. Because, I mean, around Phoenix in the high heat of summer, if you fall off your bicycle, you become a burn victim in the hospital. That's how bad it is here. But, but sometimes. Yeah. Even sandals, it's too hot for me here. You know, in the high heat of summer, I'll put on shoes in order to keep my feet cooler than sandals would keep them. So,
wow.
I don't know.
Yeah. That's an
so
idea.
So here's an interesting article in the dreaming stuff. They've identified parts of the brain. So there's a lot of brain research going on in some of these articles. And makes me wonder where they're going to go with it eventually. I've heard a lot about the pineal gland and its ability to sense things that you wouldn't see with other senses. Let's see.
Yeah, if you remove someone's pineal gland, what is it supposed to do to you? If the doctor was to operate, I wonder.
So here's an article: how to activate your pineal gland and awaken your psychic ability. Third eye pineal gland. Detox and decalcify your pineal gland, and there's ways to do that if you're removing fluoride from your water and eating your greens and your minerals, then eventually it'll pull the calcium and the fluoride out of your pineal gland, which supposedly makes it work better. This is my question, though. What does the pineal gland do? I mean, has science officially ignored psychic ability, except for the dark ops CIA things? The pineal gland is an endocrine gland, like the pituitary gland, thyroid gland, adrenal gland, and pancreas, like other endocrine glands that secrete the hormone, in this case, melatonin. The pineal gland was the last endocrine gland to have its function unveiled, partially because of its small size, roughly that of a pea, in its structural uniformity. It was not until the 1960s that scientists determined its function, having thought for several decades that it was merely a vestigial organ like the appendix. Because of our relative ignorance about the pineal gland for so long, it became the object of mystical theories and attribution. René Descartes called it the seat of the soul because it appeared to be the only brain structure not composed of two symmetrical parts, although later analysis proved this to be untrue. Compounding these rumors was the fact that the pineal gland is lodged very deep in the brain, close to its center. Various shaman tribes have claimed that the pineal gland secretes natural psychedelics and is somehow a connection between the earthly realm and a spirit world. These speculations are likely false. Why? Why? Huh. These people that still claim it. Now, what happens if you remove it, huh?
Yeah, what happens if they remove it?
Search that up. What would happen if a surgeon were to remove a person's pineal gland? Let's see. Pineal gland removed in July. I still have a conscience and I'm quite aware of the world around me. I'm still recovering from brain surgery, so I'm a bit more dizzy and slightly more forgetful. However, those are getting slightly better all the time. I no longer have a pineal gland which creates melatonin. Since surgery, I frequently use low-dose Ambien to get to sleep. My pineal gland was pretty well taken over, destroyed by a cyst. I had sleep problems well before my surgery. Having a pineal gland cyst is rare. If people with pineal gland cysts having symptoms from the cyst is super rare. The number of people in the United States that need to have their pineal gland removed is so low that you really want to see a specialist to perform the procedure. In pineal gland cyst groups, the general consensus is that Dr. Dong Kim in Houston is the most experienced, and it seems to be the most successful surgeon for the job. There are a lot of hoops to jump, though, to see him. If you're asking because you have a pineal gland cyst, if it seems asymptomatic, be glad. The majority of pineal gland cysts are secondary findings, example found during a post-rec MRI. If you're frequently in pain, having headaches, migraines, nothing seems to be working, consider trying to find a pineal gland cyst group on Facebook. There are many patients who are happy to share their experience. If you're just worried about new age pseudoscience, such as the pineal gland calcification from fluoride and whatnot, please reconsider what you're reading. Look for studies done by universities and reputable searches. Life goes on pretty well without the pineal gland. I'm still working to have a better relationship with sleep, but life keeps going. I'm just in a lot less pain now. That's what she says. The primary function is to produce melatonin. Another answer, melatonin hormone.
So therefore, the sleep is the biggest issue then, if it's creating melatonin.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah.
It is a typical youth gland act at the 10th year of life begins to decrease. Yeah. The secretion of the pineal gland has to puberty, the pineal inhibitory effect on the hormonal activity of the gonads. I don't know what he means by that.
What? Did I hear gonads?
I don't know. It was a scrambled sentence. I didn't understand what it said.
Yeah,
it is a typical youth gland. After the 10th year of life begins to decrease, the secretion of the pineal gland has to puberty the pineal inhibitory effect on the hormonal activity of the gonads. I don't know what he said. I don't know what he said.
Does that mean
if they take out
the pineal gland, that the gonads are going to go crazy? Is that it? You know, the hormones are going to be
or
all
maybe
over the
just
place
in your teen years.
In a certain years. Huh. Well, that is odd. Never thought much about the pineal gland.
No. Well, that's all I'm seeing, that it has to do with sleep. That's the official story. Now, you know, we know that the CIA was doing a lot of psychic experimentations in the 50s and 60s and probably much later. And there was that, I watched a Russian documentary the other day, there's the Russian influence on, but it was English subtitles on a lot of psychic research that the Nazis were doing even before World War II. And they knew they were going to start attacking countries, and they wanted to leverage a weapon. And so they were using psychic things to, I don't know, they were doing, what do they call, astral projections and stuff, and finding out weapons and things like that. And, you know, it seems like, you know, I've been watching Dr. Stephen Greer about UFOs and stuff, and he said actually that our own scientists reverse engineered the Roswell crash disk, and that they've had that technology now since the 50s. Well, apparently the Germans had it in the 40s, and that would explain the race to get it in, you know, get it fast. And they use rotating magnets somehow in order to defeat gravity, and so they're not using aerodynamics, they're just leveraging off the magnetic field of the Earth, I think, to do anti-gravity. But that's the whole spiel that, we know that the neocons are trying to gin up World War III, and if they can't get us to decide to bomb China or North Korea or Russia, then they're going to try to fake an alien attack. Because they have the weapons to do it. They can pretend to be aliens and just hoax it. You know, all these false flags, and that's the ultimate false flag, is to pretend the aliens are getting it. So that's, I'm wandering off into psychic stuff. And I mean, but all sciences are pretty much connected. And I had a philosophy class in college that said, you know, all these divisions between the sciences are really artificial.
Yeah.
They're all connected somewhere. You know, one science connects to the next. So that's where I was going with
may
that.
I say, may I say, science, that covers an awfully broad topic, you know, and scientists covers a very broad topic. I mean, look, you've got geneticists, you have geologists, you have cosmologists, you have, toxicologists, you have botanists, you have chemists. So you've got, you know, all these subdivisions of science. You know, you could practically take any of those subdivisions of science and see, you know, who is right and who is wrong, what kind of, conflicts are going on between different people in that group that believe different things, you know. I mean, take something like seismology. There's people that are ready to put explosive charges down to the middle of a seismic fault just to see what it would do. You know, it might create an 8.0 earthquake or something, but there's seismologists.
That's a mad scientist. Not even considering the damage they could do.
Yeah.
You know,
but, I mean,
we have enough going on.
That would be fun to see. Yeah, it would be fun to see what would happen. As a matter of fact, that might be the way somebody, an enemy nation could do terrible things. You know, you get a bomb down into this, you know, San Andreas Fault, or that fault that goes outside of Tokyo, or, you know, wherever in the seismic regions of the world. Although they're not all seismic, you know. Most of the United States is not even seismic. I was just thinking about that the other day.
Well, more and more parts of it are.
90% of all the earthquakes occur on the Ring of Fire. The Ring of Fire, you know, that goes all the way around the Pacific. But there's strange things that have happened with earthquakes. The 1811 and 1812 New Madrid earthquakes that were basically in eastern Missouri, like right on the Mississippi River area there were like 8.0 on the Richter scale. There were three earthquakes spread out over a couple of month period. And I mean, they made bells ring in Boston and South Carolina that were so strong.
Oh,
if they had happened 100 years later, if they had happened 100 years later, they would have killed thousands, tens of thousands of people. St. Louis would have vanished. Memphis would have vanished. Chicago might have been toppled over, you know. A lot of the Midwestern cities would be gone. But fortunately, it happened in 1811, 1812, when none of that area was built up yet, you see. Here's the mystery. That is not on a major seismic area. It's not on a plate boundary. It's not on a plate boundary at all. You have to get down into the Caribbean to find a plate boundary, or you have to go all the way over to the San Andreas Fault in California. So that was a very mysterious series of earthquakes, and it just shows you can't tell where these earthquakes are going to pop up, you know. There's, for most of Italy and most of Europe, there are no earthquake faults there. The earthquake faults are south up there. They're those sort of like midway down the Mediterranean, you know, like let's say about where Sicily is, and east from there to Greece, and then across Turkey and the Middle East, you know. But so every once in a while, that intrigues me. They have these rogue earthquakes, these big rogue earthquakes.
Yeah, I wonder.
I'm beginning to think maybe it's sunspots or something. I'm beginning to think maybe it's
coronal. Oh, well, yeah, we know that.
Something like that.
Suzanne, are we pretty sure
that it is solar activity that's causing earthquakes in many cases?
The recent ones right now with the magnetic storms going on, the helium cloud, the magnetic storms, but also the coronal holes. When a coronal hole faces the Earth and that solar wind comes out, or there's a coronal mass ejection and it hits the Earth's magnetic field, it puts all that energy gets directed into our poles. And then it would go to the core and heats up the interior of the Earth, as we have all these extra volcanoes and earthquakes and floods and things going on.
So it would be volcanism. There'd be volcanism and there'd be seismicity. There'd be the seismic activity and there'd also be volcanoes.
Yeah, that's what they say is some of that's going on right now. And I'm wondering if
I think it was Iceland, wasn't it? Weren't they saying that there were four volcanoes in Iceland that were ready to go, that were sort of like stirring, you know? That was just the other day, 2 days ago.
Let me see.
Iceland volcanoes.
Yeah. This is, well, okay, that's before it's news. I'm not sure that's much. Let me find, the Daily Mail. That's the same place that we read about the research on the HIV. Yeah, it's taking a minute to load the page. But I'm wondering about that big earthquake that you mentioned in 1811 and 12. Could that have been with no fault there? Could that have been like a large, like a really large underground cavern that suddenly collapsed? Would that cause that kind of a...
I never thought of it, but, you know, they say that there's 90% of the big caverns in the world have not even been discovered yet, you know. They're laying in wait.
Here is another ash cloud about to cause travel chaos. Four of Iceland's volcanoes are on the brink of erupting, and this is dated, last month, February. Paul Einarsson, a geophysicist at the University of Iceland, made the warning. He says that Katla, Hekla, this is an alphabet I don't know.
Hekla, I've heard of Hekla.
Barabunga and Grimvoten will all erupt.
Hekla,
while
is
all
where
four
the
volcanoes.
Craze. What the heck came from? That's what I heard.
Well, all
what
four volcanoes
heck?
Are closely monitored. Yeah, by geophysicists, it's very hard to predict which will erupt exactly when the extent of the eruptions. With 130 volcanoes
that
both
ash
active.
Cloud? Planes could not fly through that stuff.
That's what they're talking about, that it might happen again if all four of these go off at once.
Wow.
Iceland is one of the most intensely volcanic places in the world. It's got 130 volcanoes. Volcanoes in question are those names again, three of which have already erupted in the last 20 years. The warning follows the 2010 explosive eruption of Icelandic volcano Ijeff Fajala cool, which caused more than 10 million air passengers to be stranded and cost the economy an estimated 4 billion euros. Goes on with a description of each volcano.
I'm looking at a world map, and Iceland is right on the border between the North American plate and the Eurasian plate. So it has a lot of tension there, a lot of tension. The border goes right up the middle of Iceland, and that's what makes it so, prone to volcanic eruptions.
Wow.
Man, do you know what a real mystery is, Suzanne? A real mystery?
Yeah.
Is why do they have the, why do these plates exist? It's kind of like if you imagine a ball, like a soccer ball or a basketball or something, but it has been pushed or shoved or beaten with a stick or something, and you have these plates that form over it, like a few dozen of them, two dozen of them. It's almost like, let's say a large body, like, you know how they talk about Nibiru, you know, came close to the Earth, and the gravitation was so strong that, let's say, it stretched the Earth somehow. It stretched the skin or the top layer of the Earth, and it just basically cracked. These are cracks in the Earth, and in places they're very intense. Like, for example, if you go over to, like, in north of Australia, around Indonesia, you have the Eurasian plate, the Filipino plate, the Australian plate, the Pacific plate, and a little bit of the North American plate that comes down towards Japan. They all kind of, there's like one central point. They all can, now the possibility might have been that maybe hundreds of millions of years ago, let's say there was a big asteroid or, you know, comet, or, I mean, presumably an asteroid or meteor that hit right there. And could you imagine it hit hard enough to crack the surface of the Earth, and to crack it here, to crack it there. Maybe this has happened several times. Maybe this happened several times to create these. The Caribbean plate is a tiny plate. It's just around the place where they think that the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs landed. It's right in that the bay, I don't know what's it called, the Bay of Campeche or something. Yeah, between South America and Cuba, with Mexico on the west, that's where there is this little Caribbean plate. And there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 plates sort of like all around it. Well, you get an asteroid that's big enough, maybe it just cracks through the surface, and the surface of the Earth just cracks like on a pie or something. You know, if you apply enough pressure, it'll crack. I've always been fascinated by that. I really have. Ring of Fire. And all these other places in the Earth where they have they have this vulnerability. All these plates are rubbing up against each other. Yeah. The Pacific plate is rubbing up against the North American plate. It's kind of fascinating. See, I lived in California for a number of years, and so I was always thinking about earthquakes.
Were you feeling earthquakes?
Well, yeah. As a matter of fact, that's one of the things that chased me out of San Francisco. I had some real estate in San Francisco, and one day I was in the bathroom, and the whole room started shaking around, and the water in the toilet was sloshing around a little bit. And so I found it was like this little 5.4 or maybe 5.7 earthquake that had hit like Gilroy or something, 50 miles south. It was 50 miles south, but it was enough to cause the plumbing almost to spring apart, And I thought, geez, I don't want to be on the Bay Bridge when there's a big earthquake or something. I just had this vision that if I stayed there long enough, something bad was going to happen. And so that's why I'm not in California anymore. And of course, they did have the 1989, the Loma Prieta earthquake in 1989. And I was not there for that, fortunately. And they've had the Los Angeles earthquake. Now, my niece was living in West Hollywood when they had they had a name for the earthquake, jeepers. It was up in the San Fernando Valley. Was it the Somar earthquake? I don't know. But anyway, she says she was laying on the bed, and the bed was literally lifted and moved like 3 feet in one direction, 3 feet back. She swore that she thought the walls and the ceiling were going to cave in. But, you know, and that was that like about a 7.0 or something like that, or 6.9? That wasn't a huge earthquake either. But, you know, there's no place really safe in California. Although if you go east, then you get into the mountains, and then, you know, then the only problem there is Mammoth, because Mammoth is a earthquake. Pardon me, it's a caldera, and they occasionally have earthquakes. And,
look at you,
and
Mammoth wandering the Rockies. I'm like, what?
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting to look at the world as a very unsafe place, but you can see some places are safer than others, you know? Some places
yeah,
are safe,
we have all these billionaires buying buying fortresses in New Zealand and stuff.
Well, New Zealand is right between the Pacific Plate and the Australian Plate, and it has very serious earthquakes down there, very serious, you know?
Well, then,
in
what
history,
are they thinking?
I think they've been... Yeah, they could all be done for in a big tsunami. And also, of course,
okay.
South America has huge tsunamis coming from Chile and Peru and stuff. And those could
the
cross
Andes
the
are
Pacific.
Quite high.
Yeah.
So
well,
listen, I need to take one more commercial break before we run out of time. So let me do my duties here, and we'll be back in minute or two.
Hi guys, it's me, your host, Red Gypsy, reminding you to come journey into freedom with me every Monday night at 10 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. This is going to be a show that's going to cover everything from metaphysics to holistics to herbs to gardening to barefooting to grounding and so much more. Dare to be different, dare to be you, and dare to learn to love yourself unconditionally. Namaste.
Need a reason to stay up on Thursday night? Late Night Across America with Michael and Debbie is the new show of returning veteran internet hosts Michael J. Weber and Debbie Lewis. Late Night Across America with Michael and Debbie will cover as many topics as they can in pursuit of knowledge. It's the only way to make informed decisions. It'll be worth staying up for. So join us from 9 p.m. to 10:30 p.m. Pacific, 11 p.m. to 12:30 a.m. Central, every Thursday night on Freedomizer Radio.
Hey, Freedomist, join me, Proof Negative, weeknights, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern, 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Pacific, as we fight the New World Order together, right here on Freedomizer Radio, your exclusive home of the Proof Negative Show.
Quest Radio, Saturdays, 12 p.m. Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. With your host, Tia Severino, we'll be talking about the questions that you want answers to. Find us on freedomizerradio.com.
We're going to tell him. We're going to tell him. You're going to tell him. Should I tell him? I'm going to tell him.
Let's tell him.
Let's tell him.
Yeah.
We're going to tell him together?
Yeah.
I'll tell him. Okay. What are we telling them?
About Hope Radio.
Oh, yeah. When is that on?
Tuesday, 9 p.m. Pacific on Freedomized Radio.
So Hope Radio follows the Proof Negative Show, which immediately follows Mad Scientist Exposed here. So you want to be sure and catch those shows, too. Just set your... computer on play and go about, you know, with your evening activities and listen in. Okay, Adam, back.
Hey. I'm sorry that I got all carried away with earthquakes.
No, no.
And everything. I thought that they would fit in kind of nicely is to all the stuff that you've been talking about in the last month or two. You know, about cosmic stuff, the sun. Radiation and
it's
the
related.
Coronal mass ejections and all that, and also like what if there is a big rogue planet up there or a brown dwarf star or something, you know, according to all these stories, we see them on the internet all the time.
Yeah.
You know, the one is supposed to come by every 3,600 years or something. And, you know, what kind of things could it do? Well, it would definitely have a big effect on the volcanoes and on earthquakes and probably some tsunamis and other things too. Very fascinating.
In our rotation, in our orbit. And, you know, one of those science channels was going through a lot of science papers on the moon and stuff and lunar orbit. The lunar orbit is changing. It's becoming more elliptical. And the only way they could attribute it was to either a terrestrial planet, that meaning a rocky planet about the size of the Earth, about 30 astronomical units away, or a gaseous giant about 200 astronomical units away. And but there's the theory that there's this Nibiru that has a very elongated orbit, that it's normally way far out there, but that it swings in close like a comet before swinging out again about every 3,200 years or so. And so there's these, you know, people going over these ancient cuneiform tablets talking about all the destruction that Nibiru, you know, goes through, and, you know, civilizations collapse every 1,000 years. You know,
is it a guy by the name of Stichkin or something?
I read a couple of his books. I thought he was a nut, at least at the time, because I'm not going to believe 3,000-year-old cuneiforms, but I will believe our satellite data and, you know, and the orbits of things changing that can only be explained by, you know, gravitational forces and things like that.
Now,
so
let me get into
maybe
the
he's
fact
not
that I do not believe. I just do not believe what I hear from our friend BP Earthwatch on YouTube. He's a very good solar scientist. I mean, he keeps track of all this solar stuff. But he has this wild idea that Jupiter, our familiar planet Jupiter, which is in a safe orbit, you know, that that is Nibiru. What he thinks that that actually pops up from its orbit once in a while and swings in closer to the sun or something. Does it go rogue?
I don't know. Or we just match up some kind of, you know, finally match up in sync somehow, and that's how we get so close to it. I'm not sure. Now, he uses some software that he got from, I think it's NASA, called Eyes on the Solar System. And I downloaded it, but I haven't installed it yet. But you can dial it up and see where any planet is at any given time. Any planet that we know about. I don't think that they've programmed in Nibiru, but they have programmed in Jupiter. And, you know, this other scientist is saying, look, we're getting solar wind from two different directions. It's a gaseous giant, and that's what's making all these magnetic storms in the solar system, because these solar winds are hitting each other at cross points and you know, making all these magnetic storms out there. And, you know, BP Earthwatch was saying, no, that's it's Jupiter, and Jupiter right now is on the other side of the sun from us. Well, now we're seeing, well, it's right next to the moon. If you want to look out there, folks, tonight it was there last night. Well, it's kind of cloudy here, but the problem with Venus.
Yeah.
Well, Venus is closer to us right now than the sun is. You know, Venus orbits the sun faster than we do, and so if Venus is closer to us right now than the sun, then it's, we're only seeing it slightly edge on, or we're seeing a crescent of it. And BP Earthwatch had a telescopic photograph of Venus that had the whole night side of Venus lit up. I'm like, well, how does that happen unless there's something else in the solar system shining on Venus? So that's actually, even though he was working really hard to convince me that that Nibiru was Jupiter, while telling me that, well, it was actually on the other side of the sun from us, lighting up the backside of Venus, and that convinced me that there is something else in the solar system that we're not aware of that's actually shining light.
Yeah, but you know what? It's
but
not
it's only
Jupiter.
Visible from the southern hemisphere.
Let me tell you why. The full moon yesterday was between Aries and Libra, and Jupiter was in about 22 degrees of or 20 or 22 degrees of Libra. That's where the moon was. The moon was going right past Jupiter as we see it from Earth, you see. And the sun was over there on the other side in Aries, in 22 degrees of Aries. So that means let's picture this if we can. So the sun was really between the sun and Jupiter on the other side, where the moon was, on the other side of the Earth. So I guess there could be a tidal pull. You could say there's a tidal pull with the sun on one side and Jupiter on the other. But does that fit into what BP Earthwatch was saying about the position of Jupiter?
No, that's why I'm confused now. Because if Jupiter was on our day side, on the other side of the sun, and all of a sudden here it is on our night side, right next to our full moon, then I'm kind of confused, because if Jupiter is to light up Venus, why isn't it bright enough to light up the Earth, unless it's all, you know, awash in the moonlight and we can't tell?
Yeah.
I don't know, but that photograph of Venus really kind of shook me up.
But it is closer, because you know what, if Jupiter was in a conjunction with the sun, when we look at it, if they're both in Aries right now, then that would mean that Jupiter's way on the other side of the sun, 500 million miles or whatever on the other side, and it would be farther away from Earth. It'd be 600 or 700 million
right.
miles.
It wouldn't be lighting up the night side of Venus from our perspective.
No, no. But how could it be lighting
up
the side of Venus anyway? I'm confused. Are you confused?
Yeah, I have to install that software and find out exactly where. You know, maybe they're telling us there's another planet in Jupiter, and it's not. I don't know.
Well, take a look at a scientific ephemeris of the planet's places where it has 100
That's
years.
That's what the software gives me. I'm just afraid to install it while I'm on the air. It might knock me off. It might overwhelm my excuse. You know, it requires so many CPU cycles that I can't, you know, I can't sign off or anything like that. So.
And speaking of signing off,
so. Yeah, it's called Eyes on the Solar System, and it's from NASA. And it's great. You know, you can see where any planet is at any given time. And, you know, it's and some comets and stuff. And it has a really nice picture of what are called Trojans, which are these, you know, I thought the asteroid belt was circular, but it's not. It's just these two giant globs, you know, that precede Jupiter and are behind Jupiter, even though they're closer in than Jupiter. Called Trojan asteroids, and so we're you know.
And those are the Trojans, huh? Okay.
That's what they're labeled on the software. I was like squinting at the little labels,
you know,
that he
displayed.
There's
also trans-Neptunians. There's also some asteroids called trans-Neptunians, which are either farther out, and then they have the Oort cloud, and you know, I mean, God, they have comets and asteroids circling the sun, halfway to the nearest star.
Wow.
You know?
Well,
I
am going to have to apologize. I'm going to have to apologize. I'm way out of time. But everybody join us next week. We should have Christopher Wyatt, A Man on a Mission, regarding diseases and vaccines, and his documentary.